Please listen carefully.
Hello, universe, and welcome to the Optimist Daily Update. I'm Christy Jansen.
And I'm Summers McKay.
And we are part of the team behind the Optimist Daily, making solutions the news. We bring you reader-funded solutions news every day in order to change the tenor of news media, social media, and the direction of your day to one focused on solutions.
Every single day, we publish positive news stories written by award-winning journalists and delivered online to your inbox and through our social channels. And now we are sharing these solutions in commute-worthy, walk-worthy, home office-worthy, can't-wait-to-talk-about-our-hair-color-worthy podcast. Today is Thursday, August 20th, 2020. So realistically, here's the conversation. People everywhere are coming up with alternative ways of beauty care and hair care, and here in California, salons are still not really open, and a lot of people are still not comfortable, and I myself am not comfortable going to a salon. So I ordered my hair color from Madison Reed. Now, let me preface this. None of the following is an advertisement. It is just a conversation between two Goldilocks with really big opinions. I colored my hair. I colored the base color. It looks fantastic. I was super excited. At first, I was a little nervous, but then all things considered, it's worked out. I'm kind of ready. It's been, I think, 4 weeks, so it's kind of time to maybe bump up with some highlights. Overall, it's given me a little bit of breathing room in this whole beauty care routine. Christy, how'd you do?
Inspired by you, Summers, I was like, hey, I could actually do my own. I usually get highlights, so my hair was getting a little dim. I just felt blah. So I was like, hey, I'm going to copy Summers. And I went on. For some reason, even though I typed in Madison Reed, I got directed to the alternative competitor site, which is eSalon, and I went ahead and I ordered my color, and they have a unique colorist. They do a lot of good upselling. So I got mine. It came in the post a few days ago, and yes, last night I did it. I did my hair, and I was not as happy as Summers is.
Yeah, I was gonna say, and... I did
my base, my roots, because my ends were still quite blonde, but they turned kind of coppery. So I look a little bit coppery. So honey, I said to my husband, how do you feel about redheads?
What was your husband's response? Does he think it's as bad as you do?
No, he doesn't. He's like, well, it's done, so it's fine. You know, and he actually was a pretty good sport. But then I had on a show on that I watch sometimes called Good Bones, and it's a mother-daughter team in Indianapolis that flip houses, and they're both redheads. It came on, and he started laughing his head off, and I'm like, why are you laughing? He said, because you look like you want to be one of the Bone sisters.
So on Zoom on Skype, which is what we are recording on, Christy's hair does not look bad. It definitely does look like you changed the color. It looks great. But that is one of the risks of dyeing your hair at home, is that you can get really surprised by what happens.
This morning I woke up, I was in a much better mood about it than I was last night when I was pretty much in horror.
Well, if anybody was wondering why Christy wasn't on the show yesterday, it was because she was doing her hair.
That is not true. That is not true.
But anyway, let's shift. Thank you all for sticking with us through that scintillating conversation about my Sicilian blonde and Christy's copper blonde. What else is exciting for everyone today on the Optimist Daily, Christy?
The one I wanted to focus on, which I think is only on the Emissary feed this morning because it's number 10 in our top solutions, I feel like is one of the most important things that we have to think about moving forward. The headline reads, is the era of single-family home zoning over? Portland says yes. This is from the policymaking part of the Optimist Daily. And I think this is one of the more interesting conversations going on right now in the building world and in just how we want to think about what kind of communities we want to build. The reason I think this is an essential part of the conversation is that the policies that we make, the way that we do zoning, can shape the nature of a community for generations. And if you think about the redlining that went on back in the 40s, 50s, 60s, 70s, that kept families of color out of certain neighborhoods, that made it so that people couldn't buy homes in an easy way, just wherever they wanted to, wherever they could afford, because of policy and zoning laws. And the single family zoning has really been a bane for a lot of cities around the country, where, you know, 70-75% of the city is zoned for a single family home, which is that white picket fence, that idea of the ideal American family. But it also is not very effective use of space, and it leads to suburban sprawl. It leads to needing to be totally reliant on personal vehicles to just be able to get to your jobs. And if we want to imagine a greener, more inclusive future, and also one that doesn't have the limited housing options that we're feeling right now, which leads to no affordable homes for young families, it leads to people ending up living in their cars in some communities, which happens a lot here in California, where real estate is outrageous. Even to rent a one-bedroom house or one-bedroom apartment here in Santa Barbara, I think I'm seeing things for like $2,000 for a one-bedroom in Santa Barbara, and we're not the worst. Anyway, I think this is a super important conversation. This article goes into the whole conversation around Portland, because the residential areas in Portland, more than 70% of them have been zoned for single family homes. But there's a new initiative called the Residential Infill Project, just got approved by the Portland City Council. And part of that will sharply limit building sizes. And it also will legalize up to 4 homes on almost any residential lot, which is a tremendous shift in the policy and in the zoning for the city of Portland. And one of the reasons that people in Portland are very supportive of that is they really don't want to encroach on the nearby landscape and take over more and more natural land by filling it with homes that are not very efficient in terms of square footage. And for me, this whole thing about having tons of personal space is something that is completely foreign to me. Admittedly, I'm not a typical American in that, perhaps. Culturally, I don't really think that it's the best thing in the world to have a huge amount of personal space and have tons of isolation. I feel like that leads to other problems. But I grew up on a boat where I had my duffel bag, and that was my personal space was a duffel bag, you know? So
in a lot of areas, you see large-scale housing developments, and the combination of residential and commercial is happening. And residents' reactions are really varied. I know in my neighborhood, there is a development happening, you know, just about 3 blocks away. And a lot of my neighbors and friends' initial reaction was very, oh, I can't believe they're doing that construction. Oh, what will it do for traffic? Then I said, guys, we have literally walking distance from our entire community, walking distance. We have one rinky-dinky liquor shop and a couple really, really rinky-dinky dive bars. This is going to bring in a great number of small businesses. It's going to give us access to perhaps a local salon, perhaps other restaurants. You know, maybe it, as Amelia and I were even talking yesterday, who knows, maybe it could be a community refill shop where we could have reusable, you know, beauty goods. And so I think that even though high density commercial and residential can be off-putting to people who are accustomed to the idea of single family housing, it actually can really add some vibrancy and some real business and flood a community with revenue and business opportunities. Something else that I read yesterday was that during this pandemic, the price of rentals has actually decreased in some of the most expensive zip codes, simply because people are moving away from these very, very expensive zip codes to live, you know, either returning to their family homes, since everybody's going to work from home. So if we're all going to work from home, if we're going to have these remote communities, a high density living actually allows us to continue to foster a sense of community, even in the absence of work being that central focus of community. So I'm a big fan of it. I'm excited for it. I will say that key to any of these developments is a large amount of open space and green space so that there are places for children to play. Yeah. But I think this is a really exciting solution.
But I think what's important about that is reinvesting in the public sphere and those kinds of shared communal spaces that can really promote community outside of the home, as opposed to putting it all behind your own fence, right? Your kids have a great backyard, but the kids across town have nothing, right? Where is that, and how does that really promote social cohesion? I think having spaces where people can interact that are public and beautiful and well-maintained That's where we should be investing. And so nice, fantastic public spaces that are shared in smaller personal spaces.
Speaking
about changing the conversation, what is your...
Well, I want to first start by telling a little story. I have a very, very dear family member of mine who lives up in the Davenport area of California. It's kind of North California coast. And unfortunately, there was a lightning strike fire that occurred in her neighborhood. And she and all of her neighbors lost an entire community of housing yesterday. And literally dozens and dozens and dozens of homes were burned to the ground. And these are just family homes. I grew up as a child visiting Lily's family home in Davenport on a road called Last Chance Road. It's where I saw my first newts. It's where I ate my first pesto that was from basil grown in my aunt and uncle's yard. I grew up having no pets of my own, but Lily always had cats, and the cats would pounce about her outdoor beautiful garden. And that's where I learned to love cats. It's where I saw my first deer, and her home is gone. The reason I tell this story is because what it speaks to is the value of climate change convincing storytelling beats facts. A recent study demonstrated that storytelling can actually be far more effective in persuasion in understanding the climate change effects than battering people with repeated facts. You know, we've all heard world's temperatures risen 2 degrees Fahrenheit since 1880, carbon in our atmosphere, parts per million, blah, 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 right? We've heard the facts, but facts rarely convince people to change an emotional position. So in this study, a storytelling infrastructure was set up where a 66-year-old man from North Carolina enjoys hunting and fishing and described his sadness in seeing climate change degrade his favorite natural habitats. Well, those listeners of the stories who often noted themselves as conservatives and moderates reported feeling a greater concern for changing climate and environment when presented with the story versus just facts alone. What I love, love, love about this solution is it reminds us that we are people, not facts, that we have behaviors, we have histories, and whether or not there is any clear indication as to why the climate is changing, and we recognize that there is a lot of varied input, we do know that the climate is changing, and we have to make decisions as a culture and as a world about how we're going to respond to that. So that's my little storytelling today, and I'm sure that if you are passionate about climate change, you've got some storytelling for yourself. You have a family location or a favorite place you went as a child that is affected by climate change.
It could be like right now, like your cousin who lost her home and her land. I mean, she's now homeless and dealing with that. A lot of people in California have had to deal with that over the last couple of years. There's people who have been affected by flooding in, I think, was it Iowa, where the crazy winds, the derecho winds have come up and wiped out whole farms and homes. And I just feel like what this story is pointing out is the way that human beings deal with the world is relational, it's emotional, about narrative. And this is why in the past, we have not been very successful in changing people's minds, because people don't like to be told how to be or what to be. But if they can identify with a human story, if they can understand the people, the humanity, that's where the connections are built. And that's where the minds and hearts are shifted. It's not about, you know, batting people over the head with judgmental or horrifying facts. It's about connecting to the human stories. And I think this is why I really appreciate this solution. And just remembering that this is how we create a world that works better also, is by connecting with each other and reimagining and telling the story of how it could be, but also acknowledging where the pain is and where the suffering is. And so, I appreciate this one.
Well, in connecting with how it could be, other solutions on the Optimist Daily today include scientists rediscover a tiny elephant shrew species after 50 years in the fuzzy, adorable creatures version of the Optimist Daily. A story about the USPS and a delay for additional cutbacks until after November's election, how to be a more humble person. If humility is something that you want to embrace, take a look at that article. There is a beautiful story about scientists listening to Borneo's rainforest to protect biodiversity. Christy, what else is on here today?
Well, there's a story about what architects can do to ease PTSD from veterans. And this is about changing the built environment to make it human responsive, which I think is super important. Video game makers band together to help protect the environment. Another good design solution there. Five ways that parents can make room for joy in these difficult times when dealing with their children. And that's important for the kids, but it's also important for the parents to reconnect with their joy. Electric cars can save thousands of lives and billions of dollars. Of course, this is one of my favorite stories. And that is it for the Optimist Daily today. We are so happy and pleased that all of you tuned in for yet another edition of the Optimist Daily Update. Thank you for listening. We promise to continue to share these positive solution-based stories every day, as Summer's pointed out.
Every single day, there's optimism coming your way.
Yes, ideas on how you can participate in this changing world to help ensure it is changed for the good. And we promise, as always, to cover the current events with accuracy, legitimate sources, and to continue to offer you the information needed most to chart new paths for all of us.
Please, please, please consider becoming an emissary on theoptimistdaily.com, and for just $5 a month, support reader-funded independent journalism. Be part of the solution, changing consciousness and addressing our world's biggest challenges with a problem-solving mindset. Let's keep the Optimist Daily free to all who need it. Supported. Let's keep the Optimist Daily free to all who need it, supported by those who can. Thanks, Cleo.